Christians are traveling people. They're always in transit to someplace else. This earth is not the home of Christians. It's not the final resting place of Christians. Now, we know that Christians are not obligated to keep the Old Testament law. That doesn't mean, though, that it's not worthy of serious study, because it certainly is. There are still some important spiritual principles that overarch both the Old and New Testaments and are common to both of them. So it should not be surprising that we find statements like that of Paul in Romans, the 15th chapter, verse 4, where he says, "For whatever was written in earlier times," that is the Old Testament, "was written for our instruction, that through perseverance and the encouragement of the Scriptures, we might have hope." Likewise, in 2 Timothy, the 3rd chapter, verse 15, Paul again says to Timothy, "And that from childhood you have known the sacred writings," again, the Old Testament, "which are able to give you the wisdom that leads to salvation through faith which is in Christ Jesus." So the Old Testament is still important for the wisdom that it can provide for our salvation. We need to bear that in mind. The Old Testament is important for our study. And that's because it teaches by with examples that illustrate some important principles that we need to keep in mind. Yet the Old Testament not only teaches very directly with its examples, but also teaches in what we might regard as some obscure ways, which require a mind perceptive to its insights, or the insights that it offers. And some people are not always that perceptive about what the Old Testament is teaching us. As a matter of fact, the lesson this morning is based upon scriptures that I've probably read quite a few times in the Old Testament. But within the past week, upon reading those scriptures, they struck me in a way that they have never struck me before. And that's the basis of the lesson this morning, as a matter of fact. That sort of experience or phenomenon is not that unusual, especially to those who are not looking for what the New Testament teaches in these more, what we might think of, obscure ways. For instance, Paul told, after talking or referring to Melchizedek in the 5th chapter of Hebrews, Paul says, I say Paul, we're not sure that he actually wrote Hebrews, so let me say the writer of Hebrews says in Hebrews 5, verse 11, concerning him, the him there is Melchizedek. Concerning him, we have much to say. And as a matter of fact, Paul will say much more, speak much more extensively or write more extensively about Melchizedek in chapter 7 of Hebrews. But anyway, it says, concerning him, Melchizedek, we have much to say, and it is hard to explain since you have become dull of hearing. So sometimes the Old Testament can say things that have hidden meanings, perhaps, and we need to take the time to look below the surface, so to speak, at what it might actually be saying. Another example of this is the command in Deuteronomy 25, verse 4, not to muzzle the ox while he is threshing. Now, that might seem to be a rather mundane statement, but Paul finds in it a deeper meaning, so that he says in 1 Corinthians 9, beginning with verse 9, for it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle the ox while he is threshing. Then he goes on to ask this question. God is not concerned about oxen, is he? Or is he speaking altogether for our sake? Yes, for our sake it was written, because the plowman ought to plow in hope and the thresher to thresh in hope of sharing the crops. So he uses that passage in Deuteronomy 25, verse 4, you shall not muzzle the ox while he is threshing, to teach the deeper principle that the worker is worthy of his wages, and applies that to the support of preachers of the gospel here in 1 Corinthians, the 9th chapter. I'm just making the point that sometimes we need to be prepared to pause with Old Testament passages and ask ourselves, what is really being taught here? Or is there a deeper message here? Having said that, that brings me to the primary point of the lesson this morning. Because there is one element which figures fairly prominently in the Old Testament and serves some important illustrative purposes. And that is the tabernacle, which was essentially a tent, which was later on, of course, replaced by the more permanent structure, the temple in Jerusalem. Because the tabernacle or the temple was used for purposes of illustrating some important principles, God told Moses in Exodus 25, verses 9 and 40, to be very careful to make the tabernacle according to the instructions or the pattern that he had given to him. And the reason for that we find out in, let me jump ahead a little bit here. The reason for that we find out in Hebrews 8, verses 4 and 5, is that the tabernacle was a copy, the writer says there, of heavenly things. So it was intended to teach something. And so in order to serve that purpose, Moses needed to be careful to make the tabernacle and its furniture according to God, the pattern given to him by God. Now, but I want to say now that one of the more subtly instructive aspects of the tabernacle is the poles which were inserted into rings on the side of the Ark of the Covenant. There you see a representation of it. I'm not sure how close or how accurate that representation of it is, because we don't have the Ark of the Covenant today. We don't even have a picture or painting or anything of it. But we do have a description of it in the Old Testament. And God had directed that poles were to be made and covered with gold, and rings were to be put on the sides of the ark so the poles could be inserted into these rings. And that was so that the Ark of the Covenant could be transported. The poles and the rings through which they were inserted on the side of the ark allowed the Levites to carry it. So that in 1 Chronicles 15, verse 15, as a matter of fact, it specifically says that the Ark of the Covenant was to be carried by means of these poles laid upon the shoulders of the Levites. Now, this procedure was necessary because the tabernacle and its furniture had to be taken down when the Israelites moved on from one camping place to another. So all of its furniture had to be covered, and the components of the tabernacle and its furniture had to be transported from place to place as the Israelites traveled from Egypt for 40 years toward the land of Canaan. Now, as I've said, the tabernacle was eventually replaced by that permanent building we call and is called in the Old Testament the temple, and its construction is and dedication is described in 1 Kings chapter 6 through 8. But here's an interesting statement, and this is the one that especially caught my attention. According to Exodus 25, verses 14 and 15, I actually have 1 Kings chapter 6 through 8 up there, but this passage that I'm going to read from is in Exodus 25, verses 14 and 15. And there the commandment is given, and you shall put the poles into the rings on the sides of the ark to carry the ark with them. The poles shall remain in the rings of the ark. They shall not be removed from it. I want you to bear that in mind. God gives the commandment that once the poles were inserted into the rings on the sides of the ark, those poles were never to be removed. They were to be left there permanently. And this command was obeyed to the point that even when the ark was placed almost 400 to 500 years later in the temple that King Solomon had constructed, the poles were still in it, in the rings of the Ark of the Covenant. As a matter of fact, those poles protruded apparently through the veil separating the most holy place from the holy place, the two compartments of the temple itself. And the priests who would come in to do their ministrations into the holy place were able to see those poles protruding from the rings on the ark into the holy place. Now, we can see that in 1 Kings, the 8th chapter, verses 6 through 8. And again, this is one of the two passages that especially caught my attention and formed the basis for, the primary basis for this lesson. Let's read 1 Kings chapter 8, verses 6 through 8. 1 Kings 8, by the way, is the chapter in which is recorded the dedication of the temple by King Solomon and the Israelites. It says, beginning in verse 6 of chapter 8, "Then the priest brought the ark of the covenant of the Lord to its place into the inner sanctuary of the house, to the most holy place, under the wings of the cherubim. For the cherubim spread their wings over the place of the ark, and the cherubim made a covering over the ark and its poles from above. But the poles were so long that the ends of the poles could be seen from the holy place before the inner sanctuary, but they could not be seen outside. They are there to this day." So bear in mind that back in Exodus 25, verse 15, God had commanded, once these poles are inserted into the sides of the ark, they are never to be removed. That command was obeyed for 400 to 500 years, evidently, until the Ark of the Covenant came to its final resting place inside the temple, the most holy place of the temple which Solomon had constructed. And those poles were there. The priests who performed their ministrations in the holy place, the compartment in front of the most holy place, were able to see, apparently, those poles protruding into the holy place. There's a difference. Now, they can be confusing, but there's a difference between the most holy place, which is referred to here as the inner sanctuary, and then the holy place, which was the outside compartment, or the compartment just outside the most holy place. This is where, in the holy place, the priests daily did their ministrations. And they could see those poles protruding through the veil that separated the most holy place, or inner sanctuary, from the holy place, or the outer sanctuary. That's interesting to me. It's interesting because it raises the question, why did God command that these poles, once inserted, were left there? Remember why they were there to begin with. They were there for the transportation of the ark on the shoulders of the Levites. But you could ask the question, once the ark now has come to its final resting place in the temple constructed by Solomon, what's the point in leaving the poles there? Well, of course, Solomon and his subjects left the poles there because that was the command of the Lord in Exodus 25, verse 15. Once the poles were inserted, they were not to be taken out. So they obeyed that command, even though there was no practical reason, apparent practical reason, for the poles being left in the sides of the ark, since the ark was not going to be transported anywhere anymore. It had reached its final resting place. So why not allow for the removal of the poles then, since they had served their purpose and were no longer needed in any practical way? Well, it was because God had said Exodus 25, verse 15. Once the poles are inserted, they shall never be removed. So they were left there, even though they served no practical purpose. And even protruded into the next area, which was the holy place, where they could be seen. It occurs to me that there are some practical applications, some lessons that can be learned from that fact that the poles were left in the sides of the ark for no apparent reason. What are they? Well, it emphasizes the fact and reminds God's people that their final resting place is nowhere on this earth. That God's people are indeed a traveling people. As long as they are on earth, God's people will always be in transit to another place. Because the Israelites had come to the land of Canaan, the promised land, because the temple had been built in Jerusalem and it was a solid structure, that did not mean that the Israelites were no longer to consider themselves a traveling people, because they still were. All God's people upon this earth need to regard themselves as sojourners upon this earth. In other words, not permanent residents. We're not here permanently. Ultimately, we are not citizens of this world. Earth is not our home. Earth is always for us, and we view it that way, and we should be constantly reminded of that, like the priests were reminded of that when they saw the poles of the ark protruding through the veil into the next room. We should be reminded of that always, that we're here temporarily, that our lives here upon this earth will come to an end, but our lives, our existences, that is, will not end. So that life on earth will end, but life will not end on earth. That is, our lives, our existences, that is, will go on. They will not end on this earth. When earthly life ends, God's people, like Lazarus, the poor beggar, in Luke the 16th chapter, verse 22, who upon death, it says, was carried by the angels to Abraham's bosom. We're in transit. We're going to be carried elsewhere upon death. Our lives, our existences will not end here. And Abraham recognized that the ultimate meaning of the fact that he was a sojourner, always a sojourner in Canaan, was that no matter how long he lived in Canaan, he could be nothing ultimately other than a sojourner here upon this earth. He was 137 years old when his wife died. I believe that means he had lived in Canaan 62 years. He had lived 62 years in one place, and yet he was still an outsider after having lived in Canaan for 62 years, according to Genesis 23, verse 4. He said to the natives of the land, I am a sojourner among you. I'm a stranger. I'm an alien among you. Even though he had been living in Canaan among them for 62 years at that point. And his grandson, Jacob, recognized in Genesis 47, verse 9, that really the entirety of life is just a sojourning upon this earth. In other words, we're not permanent residents. And all of this is brought out very clearly. When I say all of this, I mean the attitudes of the fathers of the Israelites, was that they recognized that their time here upon this earth was temporary, that even Canaan was not the ultimate promised land for them. So that beginning in Hebrews 11, verse 8, we observe that it says, By faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he lived as an alien in the land of promise, in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the promise. For he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. So the ultimate meaning of Canaan was symbolic. It was symbolic. It was the promised land in the sense that it symbolized the ultimate promised land. And they came around to seeing that. Reading on in verse 12, or actually let's start in verse 13. It says, for all these died in faith without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles in Canaan. No, it says on the earth. Anywhere they went. Even if Abraham had gone back to Ur of Mesopotamia, his original home, even there, in the ultimate sense, he would have been a stranger and an exile on the earth, because he would have recognized that even his earthly home was not his final resting place that God had planned for him. Going on to verse 14. For those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. And indeed, if they had been thinking of that country from which they went out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. So even if they had gone back to their original homes, that would not have been on earth, that is, that would not have been their permanent home. And they recognized that. So, we conclude then that what was true of Abraham and his descendants is true of all God's people. Again, to the book of Hebrews, chapter 4, verses 8 through 11, it says, for if Joshua had given them rest, he would not have spoken of another day after that. There remains, therefore, a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For the one who has entered his rest has himself also rested from his works as God did from his. Let us, therefore, be diligent to enter that rest, lest anyone fall through following the same example of disobedience. So Christians are a traveling people. We're always in transit someplace else. We never treat this world as if it were our home. We must never invest in it too heavily, nor take full advantage of it, as do those who regard, the people of this world who regard this world as their only home. For Christians recognize that they will be leaving this world for their real home, so that always upon this earth they are pilgrims, they are travelers. They are exiles. They are strangers and aliens upon this earth. Those are the kinds of words and concepts that Peter uses in 1 Peter 1, verses 1 and 17, and also in chapter 2, verse 11. We're strangers upon this earth. Paul says in Philippians 3, verse 19, for our citizenship is in heaven. Ultimately, I'm not an American. Ultimately, I'm a Christian on my way home. That is heaven. That ought to be my attitude. Jesus said in Matthew 6, beginning with verse 19, that we are not to lay up treasures in heaven, or rather treasures upon earth, I should have said. Because here upon this earth, those treasures can be lost or stolen or destroyed. Rather, we're to lay up treasures in heaven, where they are not subject to theft or destruction or decay. Another passage that I'll read along this line, and I have it there on the screen, is 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter. In 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, verse 26, Paul refers to a present distress. We don't know what that present distress was, but whatever it was, it had an impact upon the way that Christians in Corinth, at least, were to lead their lives, conduct themselves. But it's interesting to note that Paul goes on to say something that has application to all of us in our attitude toward our lives here upon this earth and how we live our lives as Christians here upon this earth. He says in verse 29 beginning, But this I say, brethren, the time has been shortened so that from now on those who have wives should be as though they had none, and those who weep as though they did not weep, and those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice, and those who buy as though they did not possess, and those who use the world as though they did not make full use of it. For the form of this world is passing away. But I want you to be free from concern. One who is unmarried is concerned about the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But the one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how he may please his wife. And his interests are divided. And he goes on to say, finally, in verse 35, and this I say for your benefit, not to put a restraint upon you. That is, I'm not telling you you can't marry. But even when you're married, you're going to have a different attitude toward that marital relationship than someone who is a citizen of the world would have. So he goes on to say, I'm not trying to put a restraint upon you, but to promote what is seemly and to secure undistracted devotion to the Lord. So we can't make full use of this world. Yes, we're in this world, but while others are out there having as much fun or seeking as much pleasure and happiness from this world as they can, and making all the investments that they can in order to secure that worldly happiness, we as Christians are not out to do that. Steve made reference, just as an example, to the fact that there's a box in the back for contributions. So instead of spending all our money to maximize our pleasures and our comforts here in this world, instead, we're not going to live optimally in this world with the money that we have. We're going to instead to deprive ourselves of what we could have otherwise had by giving some of our money in a contribution to the church and its work. In conclusion, whether God's people see themselves as just travelers passing through this world determines how they live in this world, and then determines whether heaven will be indeed their final home. That's the point of the lesson this morning. How do we see ourselves and our place in this world? And does that attitude that we're just traveling through, does that attitude have a practical effect upon how we conduct ourselves and live our lives here upon this earth? If it doesn't, sad to say, it would seem that heaven then would not be our final home. I'll close with one passage, particularly interesting. The Bible introduces the Ark of the Covenant fairly early in the Bible, in the second book of the Bible, about the middle of Exodus. And then it's interesting that the Bible virtually closes with a scene showing the Ark of the Covenant. And that's in Revelation 11, verse 19. I find that altogether appropriate. If Revelation, the ending book of the Bible, has us looking to our final resting place, it says in Revelation 11, verse 19, and the temple of God, which is in heaven, was opened, and the ark of his covenant appeared in his temple. And there were flashes of lightning and sounds and peals of thunder and an earthquake and a great hailstorm. So the Ark of the Covenant has indeed come to its final resting place. You'll notice nothing is said there about the poles still being in the Ark of the Covenant. No mention, no reference to the poles. The Ark then has come to its final resting place in heaven, which should be our final resting place.